Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Just over a month from now, March 29th, the United Kingdom is scheduled to withdraw from the European Union. The negotiated withdrawal agreement between the British government and the EU was overwhelmingly rejected by the British Parliament. And today, British Prime Minister Theresa May is heading back to Brussels to renegotiate some provisions in the agreement, including the Irish backstop, the provision that a hard border won't be put in place between the Republic of Ireland, an EU member, and Northern Ireland, part of the United Kingdom, as a way to lessen the chance of a resumption of sectarian violence there. Against that backdrop, a new political party seems to be emerging from disaffected Labour and Conservative Party MPs, a new independent group, as they call themselves, whose focal point is the withdrawal and what they say is the government's disastrous handling of it. My guest today is a Conservative specialist on Anglo-American relations who has followed the Brexit situation closely. Dr. Ted Broman is a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He joined Heritage in 2008, previously served 9 years as the associate director of international security studies at Yale University, a center devoted to the study and teaching of diplomatic history. He's a columnist for Newsday, Forbes, and regularly writes for the National Review and the Weekly Standard. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night, speaking on Brexit, its past, present, and future. And he joins us today here on Studio Tulsa. Ted Broman, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Really great to be with you and your listeners. Thanks, Rich.
We're a little over a month away. March 29th is the date that the UK is scheduled to withdraw from the EU. At this point, there's no ratified withdrawal agreement. As of midweek, Theresa May is heading back to Brussels to do another round of negotiations with the EU leadership. What's your assessment that's likely to happen over this next month?
Well, Prime Minister May is in a pretty difficult situation because it doesn't look like there's a majority in the House of Commons for anything like the agreement that she's already tried to pass through the House of Commons and failed quite spectacularly on. On the other hand, the EU has said that they're not really interested in reopening the agreement. From their point of view, the agreement is done and the only thing left is for the House of Commons to accept it. That makes it very difficult to reconcile the British and the European positions. It's possible that the EU will agree to adjust the political declaration, which is non-binding, which goes along with the actual binding agreement that the Commons has already rejected. But will the House of Commons regard changes in a non-binding political declaration as meeting their concerns? Perhaps, but I rather doubt it. So you end up with an irresistible force meeting an immovable object, the British wanting one thing, the EU wanting another, and both of them fairly dug in. And that is what leads me to think that the odds of a no deal are quite high, a position I've held for a number of months now.
This non-binding political agreement, explain that for people who...
So the idea was for the withdrawal agreement to be separated into two parts. There would be a 585-page formal legal withdrawal arrangement, which would cover almost every conceivable subject under the sun, from police cooperation to trade policy and a thousand other things besides that. And then there would be a fairly high-level political statement, about 26 pages, still pretty long, actually, that would set out what you might call sort of the atmospherics of the UK-EU relationship going forward. Essentially, it would contain aspirations and expressions of intention to cooperate in the future over matters that weren't covered in the formal withdrawal arrangement and to be sort of good neighbors going forward. There's nothing terribly objectionable about such a political declaration, but it's not legally binding. So if the Prime Minister May and the EU come to a political agreement arrangement to, say, negotiate in good faith over the Irish backstop issue, just to pick one subject. Well, how is one to tell if negotiations are taking place in good faith? It's not binding. Who is the judge? So a lot of people in the House of Commons would not regard such a political declaration as being anywhere close to the changes in the legal relationship that is contained in that 585-page withdrawal agreement.
This impasse that you're talking about, how much of it is due to the whole Irish question of whether you're going to have hard borders, soft borders, or where the border is going to be between the EU and the UK going forward?
In my view, the issue is almost entirely invented. It doesn't mean that the Irish issue is not a real issue, but it's been drummed up and used in the course of the Brexit negotiations for a variety of reasons.
Again, the threat of violence emerging out of this?
No, there's very little real discussion of that. The question that has been sort of brought up in the Irish context is the question of the free movement of people and of goods between Northern Ireland and Ireland proper, as
which is
it were.
EU and EU, non-EU.
EU yes. and non-EU, UK and EU. Well, there are a lot of ways that you could solve this question that would be fairly simple. For example, the UK and the EU could have a free trade area, and then goods would flow quite naturally, freely, between the North and the South. Or you could have some sort of system whereby people who cross the border regularly have what we have in the United States, some sort of highway transponder, like an easy pass system. Every time you go through the border, you just drive right through the gate, you're registered, on you go. So there are lots of ways you can deal with this. The basic problem is that the Irish question was settled because both the British and the Irish realized they had to be constructively hypocritical. For example, the British were willing to agree that Gerry Adams, the leader of the Provisional IRA, was not going to be thrown in jail for his undoubted involvement in a lot of IRA bombings. I want to defend that position morally, but it was very constructively hypocritical. Everyone agreed to pretend Gerry Adams was an innocent person. Well, he's not innocent. Well, in the same way, you could solve the Irish problem now between the UK and the EU if you're willing to be a little bit constructively hypocritical and say, look, we'll have a free trade area agreement. There'll be a certain amount of border leakage, including of people, and we're just going to agree to ignore that in the same way we've ignored the Gerry Adams problem. Well, why can the EU and the UK not be constructively hypocritical? Because the EU has found that the Irish issue gives it leverage over the EU over the UK, which it's unwilling to give up.
And, you know, even if you have this border that's leaky, then what happens between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK?
Yes. I mean, the other way to sort of resolve the question in theory is to say that Ireland and Northern Ireland should have the same customs arrangements, and then the UK, the island of England, Scotland, and Wales, should have a separate customs arrangement. But that's about as palatable to a lot of people in the UK as saying, oh, California, Oregon, and Washington should have one customs arrangement and the rest of the United States should have another one. It really is not terribly appealing to a lot of people. It basically, not to put too fine a point on it, concedes that the IRA was right. And that's not a very appealing prospect either.
You've been writing about the origins of the dissatisfaction of the UK. And of course, you go back in British history, the UK has always had ambivalent relations with Europe. In fact, they didn't even join the common market till the 1970s, 1973. So what do you see as the origins of the dissatisfaction that manifested itself in Brexit?
It's useful to divide this into long run and then shorter run concerns. The longer run concern is that going back as far as the Glorious Revolution, 1689, the British have had an understanding of the importance of the House of Commons as a representative institution. British politics revolve around the Commons to an absolutely extraordinary degree, and all of the big moments in British political history are about the House of Commons, from the Glorious Revolution of 1689, to the expansion of the franchise over the 19th century, to the Anti-Corn Law League, which petitioned in favor of free trade in the 19th century, petitioned to the House of Commons. They weren't extra parliamentary agitators. They wanted change through Parliament. The Labour Party was invented to get working men at that point into the House of Commons. So the whole British political system and way of thinking about politics is very House of Commons-centric. And that means that participating in the EU, which means that the House of Commons can no longer take some fairly important decisions about national policy, hurts the British psychologically and historically more than it hurts a lot of other places. They just have a different political understanding and history. We are much closer to the British understanding of the centrality of democratic control over national policy than the British are, for example, to the Germans or the Italians or the French. So that's the long run question. The shorter run question is that if you go back to the early 1990s, the single most popular opinion in Britain was that there should be more powers given to the EU and the EU should become stronger. And then remarkably, by 1997, that opinion had absolutely inverted.
What was the reason for that?
It's something that almost no one remembers now, but the polling, and this is not sort of your standard political polling, this is long-run polling done by respected British universities. The crisis that happens is what we remember, if we remember it at all, as the Mad Cow Crisis, BSE, when exports of British beef were, quite rightly, blocked from the continent because they were infected with something which, according to my limited understanding, is sort of like a virus.
Yeah.
And this was a perfectly reasonable thing to have done. But coming out of the Cold War, the British really thought that the EU was going to be different. It was a great new world. There was going to be cooperation, much like Americans thought about the United Nations. And then something happened to destroy our confidence. In the United States, the UN was badly affected by Black Hawk Down, the Somalia incident. And all of a sudden, the reputation of the UN in the United States craters. Whether that's fair or not is a very complicated question, but it happens. In the UK, the opinion about the EU craters because of BSE. People look at the UN in Britain, or the EU in Britain, and they say, I thought this was going to be different. In the post-Cold War world, we were all going to work together and be friends. And now you do this to me. How dare you?
So was it a matter of the blanket ban? There was no understanding whether it came from an infected area or not. It was just a blanket ban?
It was even more than that. And for what it's worth, I think that the Europeans were in the right on this and British were wrong. But it feels like a stab in the back. And you expect to be stabbed in the back from your enemies, right? That doesn't hurt so much. But when you've built up all these hopes that you're going to be friends in the post-Cold War era, and then it turns out that the French are stabbing you in the back again, that hurts way more.
And of course, you have a long history with the French and with the Germans.
And then all of that history comes back and it's even stronger. So since then, opinion about the EU in the UK has been pretty much what we saw in the Brexit referendum, 50-50. Much less popular than it was 10 years earlier, which is strange because no one now remembers BSE. But it flipped opinion anyhow, and it hardened opinion, so it's never really changed. Then even more recently, you had the euro crisis. The big appeal for the EU and the UK was always that it was economically a good idea. Well, who would look at the eurozone during the euro crisis and say, this looks great. I'm excited to be part of this plan. You'd have to be quite venturesome to think that was a good idea. And then, of course, there were very high levels of inside EU immigration into the UK, which were very unpopular in labor, left-leaning areas of the UK, which traditionally didn't much like the idea of low-wage labor being imported from Eastern Europe as they saw it to take their jobs. Now, I don't agree with that characterization, and I think Polish immigration to the UK did a powerful lot of good for the UK. But I'm not working class. And one can see how a lot of people who are working class, finding the neighborhood store speaking Polish, finding out that their kid can't get into the state-controlled school because there are lots of immigrants in the area, finding out that they can't get into the doctor, the state-controlled doctor, because there are more immigrants in the area, finding out that Poles have lots of jobs in the area, one can see how this is unpopular, whether that opinion is right or wrong. And that redounded onto Europe.
Yeah. So that was a question I wanted to ask you, because immigration has been a big part of the Brexit campaign. And it's more concerns about their fellow EU citizens coming to Britain than, say, refugee immigrants. And of course, UK is not immune like any other culture in Europe about just any outsiders not necessarily being a part of their community. That extends to even to some Commonwealth citizens.
When you look at the polling, you find that the UK is the most tolerant country with a couple statistical ties in all of Europe. which basically should sort of accord with the fundamental American sense of the kind of the place UK is. It's not really a very intolerant place. So it certainly wasn't related to refugees. It certainly wasn't related to the Syria crisis, for example, which is dragged up. The evidence is overwhelming that it was Eastern European, so white Christian immigration that was unpopular. And the weird thing is that you saw this in the Brexit referendum, that it's difficult to know, but certainly a significant minority, probably a majority of British citizens with an Indian background voted for Brexit. Why? Because they didn't like an immigration system that gave priority to Poles over Indians, which is weird when you sort of say it, but it's a perfectly logical point of view. If you look at polling now, what you find is that the British are actually quite happy to have a fairly high level of immigration. But again, this House of Commons thing comes in. They want to know that the immigration is under their control and that they're admitting the people they want to admit rather than people who just happen to be European versus doctors from India, or, you know, for that matter, Americans, because we're just as much affected as people from India are by this.
My guest today is Dr. Ted Broman. He's a senior research fellow in Anglo-American relations at the Heritage Foundation, and he was the guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations, speaking on Brexit, the past, present, and future. He said you see right now an impasse at this particular point. What's going to happen on March 29th? If there is no agreement, do you think they kick the can down the road for another year? European courts have said that that's a possibility. What do you expect to happen?
There are right now three, essentially, potential outcomes. In my view, the most likely outcome is a no-deal exit, where Britain exits the EU without a formal exit arrangement. The second most likely possibility is that some variant of Theresa May's EU agreement is passed at the very last moment. It would have to be changed from the agreement that's already been voted down, because the government can't keep on bringing the same agreement back to the Commons over and over again. So that means the EU would have to agree to change it. The third possibility is the one you alluded to, that the can is kicked down the road for, I've heard, a matter of weeks, or a month or two. I think almost certainly not a year. The problem here is that you've got European-wide elections for the European Parliament coming up in a matter of a couple months. You can fudge the time until the new parliament is seated, because the old parliament is still in charge until the new parliament is seated. What do you do when the new parliament comes in and there won't be British MEPs in it, but Britain would still be a member of the EU? What do you do about the budget? Britain is not going to be contributing if it's out. If it's still in, it's going to be contributing and not have any votes in Parliament. You get into a situation that is just, it's very difficult. Basically, things don't get easier if you kick it down the road. They get harder.
Now, I've heard that parties are preparing candidates for the EU parliamentary elections, even though they don't know if they'll actually have elections.
Yeah, they're preparing candidates, but if there is no agreement by March 29th, Britain's out, so they can't take their seats. So, you know, the problem with we'll push this off and then we'll fix it later is that the issues at stake are not going to get any easier if you delay them. You either have to bite the bullet in one form or another and have a deal, and it's not going to get any easier, or you don't. And there's another incalculable here. I'm not making a prediction, but the odds of a European recession over the next 12 months are not zero. In fact, if you take a look at recent figures of German industrial output in particular, they're not very encouraging. Is the EU going to be more or less willing to cut a deal with the British, or vice versa, if the European economies shrink next year by, let's say, 3%, to be sort of serious but not devastating?
That would be serious, yeah.
I have no idea how that affects things, but it would complicate the situation at a minimum. So this idea that things will get better if we just keep on kicking the can down the road reminds me of a kid saying, I'll pull this Band-Aid off real slow, it'll hurt less. No, it doesn't. It hurts more if you do it that way.
What happens if we have an exit non-agreement? No agreement and the exit takes place. What happens to UK citizens living abroad, the EU citizens living in the UK? What happens on the Irish border? What happens in the Irish Sea between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK?
Yeah, there are so many questions here. On the question of EU citizens in the UK, the British government has already announced that anyone who's legally in the UK as of March 29th will be grandfathered in. So there are not going to be mass expulsions, and that was never on the cards as anything that was even a vague possibility. The EU has not announced that British citizens on the continent will be grandfathered in, but given how many British citizens retire to the coasts of Spain and spend their money there, the EU has every conceivable incentive to grandfather British citizens in on the continent.
At least Spain and Portugal.
Yeah. So I'm not particularly concerned about that. Visible trade, most of the world's trade is today conducted by WTO rules. When Britain exits the EU, the WTO rules will still apply. Therefore, Britain will end up trading with the EU on precisely the same basis that we in the United States currently trade with the EU. And that's proven to be reasonably satisfactory. So the British government has also announced that they are not going to be conducting any sort of checks on the border for imports from Europe. They're just going to unilaterally assume a free trade area, thus throwing all the onus on the Europeans to start imposing checks on British products going to the continent. This is a very wise policy because it's essentially a policy of unilateral free trade from Britain's point of view. And given that Britain has a massive visible trade deficit, it is obviously in their interests not to put tariffs on their imports, which, in spite of everything President Trump says, tariffs are paid by the importing nation and the importing consumer, not by the exporter. So this is a very sensible policy from Britain's point of view. I am really only concerned about one thing in the short to short medium term. And that's that the City of London, which is going to do just fine long term, the City of London is Britain's Wall Street, essentially, right, but a good deal older than our Wall Street. The City of London, long run, will be just fine. They've been around since 1689. They're very intelligent. They're very inventive. They will survive. In fact, they will prosper. The problem is short term. All of the currency swaps held in the City of London have as their legal basis that Britain is a member of the EU. So, at the stroke of midnight on March 29th, all of those currency swaps will simultaneously, at once, lose their legal validity. One City insider expressed this to me, 10 times worse than Lehman.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, you can solve this problem very simply. All the UK and the EU need to do is to sign a one-page piece of paper saying, all contracts shall continue to have legal validity as if the UK were still in the European Union. Very simple. And then over time, those contracts will unwind and you can put them on a new legal basis, and then there's no problem. I mean, this is a real problem, but it's not a problem caused by a fundamental economic issue. It's a legal problem, not a problem of competitiveness caused by, you know, bad British policy or, you know, poor EU policy. It's simply a legal issue. But that doesn't mean it's not a real problem. That does worry me.
What about what is the mood to actually make that accommodation, a one-page agreement that will put this into play?
Right now, there doesn't seem to be much focus on this issue because both the EU and the UK government are still hoping against hope there will be a comprehensive agreement which would solve this issue and a thousand others. When we get to a week or two to go, and if there is no comprehensive agreement at that point, then you have to do this. And I really don't care what anyone thinks of the UK government or the EU in this Brexit saga. Not resolving this issue would be cataclysmically suicidal for both of them and would have profoundly negative effects on the United States. If I were to tell the United States one thing, right, and the rest of the world, if I were to tell the United States one thing right now, I would say you should go very quietly. You don't want to spook anyone. Go to the EU and the British and say, listen, you know, whatever you're going to work out, you're basically going to have to work it out on your own. But you are going to solve the immediate financial problem, and we are going to exert all of our pressure on you just to solve that short-term problem. And then you go settle the longer-term issues. You know, we have our own interests. Fine, we'll look after those. But right now, the only thing we want is you solve the currency swap issue.
One last question, and that has to do with the Irish backstop. If there's no exit agreement, will this play a role, do you think?
Will it play a role in destabilizing the island of Ireland? I don't think so. In my view, the Good Friday Agreement, which essentially brought peace to Northern Ireland, reflects things that are much, much deeper than EU membership. It reflects, above all, the fact that first the IRA was militarily defeated by the British and was thoroughly infiltrated, and secondly, that Ireland has accepted that if there is to be a reunion of Northern and Southern Ireland, it will happen peacefully and with the democratic support of people in the North. So the IRA lacks the basis that it had for many, many years in Ireland proper, where there was a significant degree of acceptance of the use of violence. Ireland is not that sort of country anymore. It is a modern, democratic, peaceful, stable, and highly prosperous, very good place to be. Millions of Americans have ancestry there, and millions more have visited it. And anyone who's been to Ireland recently will tell you that today's Ireland is not Ireland 50 years ago. That is the basis of peace on the island of Ireland, not the customs or immigration arrangements.
What role is there for the U.S. in this situation? I mean, given the fact that right now the United States' relationship with all of Europe is not all that great, but you know, they've talked about a U.S.-U.K. free trade agreement. What do you think the U.S. role is in this next few months?
Short-term, we should be pressing the U.K. and the EU to solve the short-term legal financial problem. In the medium to long-term, our interest is absolutely in a free trade area with the U.K. We have a nicely balanced trade right now. There's the potential to expand that considerably. And above all, there's the potential for us to write a trade agreement that would really be a modern trade agreement, which wouldn't privilege big companies, which wouldn't be subject to their, in my view, undesirable lobbying efforts, that would be about recognizing that the UK is basically a well-governed place and that we have our own rulemaking arrangements, and simply saying, you know, if the British say a drug is good enough in the UK, it should probably be good enough here, provided that the reverse is also true. That would, at one stroke, allow us to write trade agreements that wouldn't be so subject to corporate lobbying and corporate manipulation. It would be genuine free trade. UK has always been a great free trading nation. Let's work together on free trade.
Well, Dr. Broman, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Dr. Ted Broman is a senior research fellow in Anglo-American relations at the Heritage Foundation, and was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations, speaking last night to that group on Brexit, its past, present, and future. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.